The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Connolly, Judge Smith, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning. The next matter on for oral argument this morning is LMP versus the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Counsel, I will state for the record what the parties are aware of, which is that we are not live at the Minnesota Judicial Center, but we are entertaining the oral argument this morning by the online Zoom platform because of the ongoing pandemic and the state of emergency in Minnesota, preventing parties from arguing live. But for the sake of the oral argument today, counsel should be aware we are keeping an audio recording, not a video recording. So despite the fact that we can see your faces and see your names on the screen, our record will not have that information. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of who's making which argument in the recording. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes for relater if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. Counsel, for relator, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Russell Squire. I'm an attorney at Southern Minnesota Legal Services, Regional Legal Services, representing LMP in this matter. LMP is a 32-year-old single mother, aspiring nurse, and avid ice fisher. She has no criminal record, has extensive support in her community, and has excelled in her first 2 years of school. Despite her lack of any criminal record, commissioners have subjected LMP to a 15-year disqualification, asserting that there exists a preponderance of evidence that she committed felony possession of burglary tools, a crime for which she was never even charged. Even though LMP has twice requested reconsideration of this decision and now brings this appeal, neither the Minnesota Department of Health or Human Services has ever provided any explanation of how they reached this conclusion. Because the commissioners failed to explain their decision-making in reaching this important decision, and because any conclusion that she committed this crime would not be supported by substantial evidence, given the paltry evidence of it that is actually contained within the record, we request that you reverse the commissioner's disqualification.
Counsel, can you tell us what is the best case we should look at with respect to your claim about the absence of findings of fact? So at the procedural posture of an agency decision before the, you know, an evidentiary hearing, what case should tell us that findings are, more specific findings are necessary from an agency determination?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, going all the way back to 1978, I think People for Environmental Enlightenment and Responsibility, Inc. versus the Minnesota Environmental Quality Council is sort of the lead case on this. And that held that, you know, judicial review of decision-making is only possible if the agency states with clarity and completeness the facts and conclusions essential to its determination so that a reviewing court can determine whether the facts support the agency's actions. So I think the key concept here is that—
On that point that Smith just raised, so why doesn't the May 2nd, 2018 letter do that?
Conclusory statements aren't a sufficient basis to allow judicial review. You can see it has to be, you know, like you can look at In Re Review of 2005 annual automatic adjustment charges. An agency is not merely permitted to.
Mr. Squire, what statements in that letter are you complaining about as being conclusory?
So they simply assert that they reviewed the evidence and that it supports their finding. I think that's a conclusory statement. They have to explain what evidence that they, what they believe happened and how that evidence leads to the conclusion that she committed felony possession of burglary.
They go through the 9 factors. They talk about, you know, well, just on the first one, the nature, severity, and consequences of the event. You were disqualified for possession of burglary tools, which is an intentional offense. You were in possession of a window punch tool that officers indicated was commonly used to break out car windows. You were a passenger in a stolen vehicle. Now I understand, you know, you're arguing, you know, whether that's stolen or not. I mean, the whole sort of, you know, in which multiple burglary tools were found. I guess speaking for myself and not the panel, I'm not so sure that's so conclusory. I mean, that's, it seems to me, I mean, that would indicate somebody read the police report. Go ahead.
Yeah. A couple of things. I want to be clear. We're talking about, you know, they have to do two separate analysis here. There's the set aside request and then the request, the correctness challenge. Those are two completely sets of analysis. So they can't point to the set aside challenge and say that this is evidence that we did the correctness challenge.
I'm glad you mentioned that. So what are we looking at now? Is it the correctness?
Yes, this is only the correctness challenge.
Okay. So we're not looking at whether there was preponderance of the evidence to support the original finding?
Well, so we are. So we're looking at, is there a preponderance of the evidence that she committed felony possession of burglary tools?
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure. Well, first of all, I read, as I'm sure the panel did, Jackson, mm-hmm. to find out what exactly, you know, I mean, I'm not so sure I agree with this. And maybe the state didn't particularly argue this, but it's not like, well, we're done. You know, she didn't ask for the hearing, so we're done. Mm-hmm. I don't think I agree. Well, I don't agree with that. But then, you know, then looking at Jackson, you know, the issue is whether, the issue is whether the information that they relied upon in their making decision was correct. Mm-hmm. And I'm not so sure that's, and, you know, was the factual basis correct or incorrect for the disqualification? I'm not so sure that's the same as saying, well, now we get to review that and determine whether, whether the evidence that was presented met the preponderance of the evidence standard.
Well, I'm glad
why,
you.
Why am I wrong?
So first you can look at the Rodney case. And in that case, the commissioner essentially asserted that, you know, all this, you know, incorrect evidence means is we're just looking to make sure that it's the same person. And Rodney says, no, it's not a limited basis. Right. It's a broader challenge.
I agree. You're right.
And then you can look at the Thompson case. And in Thompson, the question, that was a slightly different issue because it was, is he entitled to a fair hearing? But that also said on this completeness challenge, you know, arguing, is the information correct?
So what information in that May 2018 decision is incorrect?
Well, so the information, they showed that the information the police, in the police report is incorrect. First, that the car was stolen. She presented information that it was not stolen. Second, that the quality of this item is that it's a burglary tool. She presented evidence, buttressing the story that she told the police at the time, that this is a safety tool her mom gave her.
Well,
she presented evidence
from
the DNR.
On the tools, mm-hmm. you know, it seems like this tool could be used to break into cars to steal stuff, or it can be used, I mm-hmm. guess, to save you from dying in the ice.
Sure.
So that's a, you know, those are two different interpretations. That doesn't mm-hmm. mean one is correct and one is incorrect, does it?
Sure, but I think it goes to, you know, the analysis for determining if somebody committed felony possession of burglary tools goes to the quality of the item and how culpable it is, right? Well, whether it's a lockpick or a safety tool matters.
Is it correct or incorrect that there were stolen items in the trunk of that car?
That's what the police report said. There's no allegation that they were in her possession or that she had any knowledge of them.
That wasn't my question. My question mm-hmm. is, I mean, I understand about the car, it was, you know, I mean, I get that. But is it incorrect that there were stolen items in the car's trunk?
That's what the police report says, and LMP doesn't have any way of rebutting that. She doesn't know.
So can I ask just to know, so I want to understand whether both parties agree, and if you agree that that the decision, the initial disqualification decision is presumed to be accurate, but it could be overcome by the evidence that your client submitted to show that it was incorrect. Is that accurate?
I think that's accurate. I think that's okay. How the presumption of correctness works. Correct.
Okay. And then your concern is that although the agency said we reviewed what you submitted, it did not explain its credibility determinations. For example, it could have found it just simply not credible for whatever reason. If it had decided, I'm quite sure you argue that the record allows for only one factual finding, and that's that the presumption was overcome. Is that right?
Yes. It's a presumption of that requires production, not necessarily persuasion at our point to overcome the presumption of correctness.
What happened? Was the production burden met but not persuasion? Is that what you're...
Well, so I guess what I'm trying to say is that in order to sort of trigger this Jackson review that we're arguing, we're not arguing that merely requesting reconsideration is sufficient. We do accept that the applicant has to produce some additional element evidence showing why the commissioner is wrong. And then once they do that, the commissioner does have to review that, which there's no evidence they've done. I mean,
there's evidence they reviewed it by virtue of their saying that they reviewed evidence, that's just statement.
Statement.
But you're saying that they needed to explain why they rejected her evidence in favor of the decision that, in fact, the police report was more credible or reliable evidence of what
Correct.
Happened.
Correct. I think that's exactly right. I think they needed to, say.
Did Jackson say that? What case says what Judge Smith just said?
So this is, the first case interpreting what Jackson requires of the court. Yeah, it would be this case. I think...
Well, there you go. At least that's clear.
Yeah. If...
Well, obviously you'd like us to publish that too, right?
Correct. Correct. I think if Jackson doesn't mean that, then what is this, additional, reconsideration request mean? If you produce evidence and the...
Well, I think as I look at Jackson, if you look at if the police report said, and the stolen items were from her mother or from some store she was at, and she can show, no, none of those items were my mom. No one ever said that. I was never at that store.
Yeah.
That's what I think Jackson, it's not just, that my name is LNP, is not LNP, but it's to show what's not true in sort of the facts. And I guess what my concern is, we're being asked to kind of reweigh the evidence under the correctness standard. And you know what, I have problems with this, but I'm concerned that what you're asking us to do is a little bit more than what Jackson says we're supposed to do. So why am I wrong, Mr. Squire?
Well, I don't think I'm asking you to reweigh the evidence. I think the commissioner is asking you to reweigh the evidence by basically asking you to reverse engineer their decision. They've come here providing no explanation for what they did, no findings of fact, nothing. And they're saying, sorry, you're muted, Judge.
Squire, at the end of the day, they sort of said, the facts are the facts and we're not changing that, but we agree that she gets the set aside because she's not a harm. It seems to me, it looks to me like the commissioner was kind of doing the stuff they're supposed to do, which is looking at everything, making, I agree, she was never charged, but, as I used to say in private practice, there are some bad facts for your client in this. And, there's not a whole lot of bad facts because that's why she wasn't charged, but, it's a different standard. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. It's preponderance of the evidence. And, this is a burglary tool. And I'm so, well, anyway, I'll let you finish, Mr. Squire. I've taken up too much of your time.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, sure, it's a burglary tool, but they have to show each element of the crime by a preponderance of the evidence, and that to show that strong circumstantial evidence of criminal intent is the, you know, language from Conaway. You know, I don't think there's hardly any evidence of, you know, her criminal intent, not her boyfriend's criminal intent, you know, not the items her boyfriend's possessed, not the items, not her boyfriend's criminal history, her criminal intent as a passenger in a car, you know, with two things in her purse, you know, this safety tool in her wallet, and then her hairstyling tools, you know, none of this, you know, inculpatory evidence was found in her possession on her. You know, this was stuff in the trunk of a car her boyfriend appears to have borrowed from somebody. And I do think that, you know, they didn't do what they were supposed to here. They can't just explain one half of the request. They requested, you know, they just explained the set aside. LMP sent them a letter saying, hey, we filed this reconsideration request. It looks like you didn't do anything with it. And they responded with a letter, you know, saying that they did. And then we get the evidentiary record. And there's no evidence that they did anything. None. And that's not acceptable. That's not what the law requires of them.
Thank you, Mr. Squire. You will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Katrin Voss. I'm with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Department of Human Services. The issue before this court is whether MDH properly denied Relator's request to rescind her disqualification from providing direct care services to vulnerable adults because the information relied upon in making that determination was correct. MDH's decision should be upheld because it is supported by substantial evidence in the administrative record. It was not arbitrary or capricious, and it was not affected by errors of law. First, MDH's decision not to rescind Relator's disqualification was proper and is well supported by the record. MDH included in the agency record the risk of harm analysis, which Judge Connolly referred to, and that document is not really at issue today because the set-aside was granted for her disqualification and Relator is able to continue providing services at Rasmussen College. But I draw the court's attention to that document because it shows exactly what MDH reviewed in its reconsideration.
What was the agency's obligation upon the submission? What was the agency's obligation relative to the Jackson case and its review here? Was it to determine whether the presumption of that, in fact, the basis for disqualification was satisfied? Was it to see whether that was rebutted?
The court in Jackson clarified what it means when a disqualification is conclusive. And of course, Relator in this case did have a conclusive disqualification from 2018. And Jackson clarified that that means that she has the ability, and she always has the ability, to request reconsideration on both the risk of harm and the correctness.
Right, and then once she does that, which I think she did here, then what's the agency's what's the standard? What's the agency's obligation?
So the standard, the burden essentially shifts because of the rebuttable presumption of correctness to Relator to show that to produce sufficient evidence that would justify a finding of fact contrary to the assumed fact. And the department looked at the information that she presented and determined she did not meet that burden, that there was not sufficient information provided to show that the information relied upon.
What about the fact that, I mean, I can't remember what this device is called, but you know, this device, you know, okay, you can break a window to steal a car, or you can, if you, you know, you can break ice. I mean, so why isn't that enough? You know, considering that she wasn't charged, that it was the boyfriend's car, and then as Mr. Squire pointed out, you know, the stolen stuff was in the trunk, but not on her person. I mean, what you know, what should the, you know, does the agent have to say, following up on Judge Smith's point, I mean, what does the agency do then when his client shows that you can use this tool for two different things? Do they have to say, yeah, you can use it for two different things, and we think she was using it to steal stuff? Or what does the agency do then in that next letter? And I am sympathetic that, like, at some point it's like, look, you got the letter. I mean, you know, what, there's no hearing. What more do you want us to do? But what do you have to do in that second letter when his client is requesting consideration, reconsideration under the, you know, doctrine of correctness? I mean, what is the agency required? What is the agency supposed to do then, counsel?
So, number one, what the agency is required to do, I think that's outlined in Minnesota statute section 245C.23, which outlines what information the agency is required to provide in a reconsideration determination. And nowhere in that section does it state that an agency needs to make the kind of detailed finding of fact that relator argues is necessary. And I would compare that to Minnesota statute section 256.0451, for example, which details what needs to be put in a fair hearing determination by a human services judge. And that outlines very clearly that a human services judge needs to make findings of fact, and each finding of fact needs to be supported by a preponderance of evidence, list the evidence reviewed. If there is a conflict in the evidence, must state the reasoning used to resolve that conflict. But there's no similar analysis required in the statute for a reconsideration determination. But in looking at the evidence, even if it's not documented in the record, there's substantial evidence that supports the department's determination here. If you look at the statute for what constitutes felony possession of burglary, it says whoever has intent to either commit burglary or use that tool to allow someone else to commit burglary or theft. I think that's a really important part of the statute in terms of this analysis, because you have the fact that relator was in a car that was registered as a stolen vehicle. There was stolen property in the car. There were crowbars and gloves and face masks in the car, all of this,
in the trunk though, right?
Some of the items, that's my understanding from the record, were found, there are stolen items in the trunk, but also the crowbar, for example, I believe was found in the back seat of the car. And you have the center punch tool, which is found in relator's purse. So if this had been a situation where relator was pulled over the police and she was out ice fishing and only had tools related to ice fishing in her car and the car belonged to her, we may have a very different situation. But the circumstances matter. And in this case, it would be unreasonable to assume the innocent situation that relator's counsel says this is versus what is in the record, which is all of these stolen items, all of these tools that are known for use in burglaries and thefts.
So the agency, well, I just want to back up then in stages. You're talking about the evidentiary support for the decision. It's interesting you say it'd be unreasonable to assume otherwise. I guess so the agency couldn't have agreed with her and found her credible. And
Your Honor, to clarify, what I meant by that is that if you're looking at circumstantial evidence, if all of the circumstantial evidence points to innocence versus guilt,
applying
it's not.
It. Okay, then let's back up a level. Then I think your argument is that there's no requirement that the agency make specific findings. And by specific, I mean saying, we don't find credible your explanation. We continue to believe the rest, the preponderance of the evidence based on the police reports, et cetera. They can just reject the challenge by saying, essentially, we reject your challenge. Doesn't seem like they just said much more than that, which is that we find you disqualified.
Correct, Your Honor. That is not required in the statute. A relator can't point to an area of the statute or a case that requires that. Certainly, it's best practice, to be candid with the court. I think a memo that details the basis of the decision, it would be best practice. But it's not required by the statute. The department complied with the law, and it doesn't mean that an agency decision is automatically arbitrary if there's no detailed explanation provided for the decision.
And then going up one more level then to Jackson, you're saying that Jackson tells us that the burden of persuasion switches to the relator, to the disqualified person, as opposed to it being an evidentiary presumption, I guess, where, you know, once there's contrary evidence, you know, it goes to zero and you have to measure the preponderance, which is what I think relator is arguing is that the preponderance of the evidence still, even if you, once you have a production of evidence, you know, you no longer have a presumption, and now it still remains on the agency. I guess it still remains to prove by preponderance of the evidence, to reconsider whether the violation that's at issue was proved by preponderance of the evidence. So I'm trying to figure out that. It doesn't seem to talk about burden shifting. It just talks about rebuttable presumption. And what are we to make of that?
Your Honor, I read Jackson that if a disqualification is conclusive, the relator doesn't get a fair hearing, but they do have the ability to produce evidence. So perhaps it is a burden of production, but that evidence still has to go to whether it has to justify a finding of fact contrary to the assumed fact. It can't just be any information that's submitted to the agency.
I'm seeing it says it puts the evidentiary burden on a disqualified individual to put forth evidence of the incorrectness of the decision, which I assume we would say you would agree happened here. There was evidence of the incorrectness. It may not have been credible, but or not. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
The department's position is that relator did not submit that sufficient evidence that disputes that correctness. So they did not meet their production of their burden of production or persuasion.
And what would that evidence look like? Let's assume the facts were somewhat different. What additional facts would have been necessary to meet a burden of merely production in this case?
It's certainly a case-by-case determination, but to go down that hypothetical, if her later had submitted information, for example, that she didn't know the individuals in the car, that she had just been picked up in this car minutes before the police had pulled the car or initiated the traffic stop, that certainly would dispute the necessary intent that those tools would be used for, a burglary tool. That's just an example I'm thinking off the top of my head. But other examples from other cases would be if a disqualification is made based on a conviction and the department relied on incorrect information about the conviction or the disposition in that case, then that would be another example of the department relying on incorrect information. But what really matters in this case is that the agency decision has to be based on, there has to be a reason behind the decision. There has to be a rational connection between the facts and the agency's decision. In this case, MDH provided that reason in its reconsideration determination of May 27th. And the reason is that relator did not meet her burden in showing the information used to disqualify her was correct.
So if all the agency has to do is say, essentially, we reject your challenge, which is, I think, essentially what happened here, isn't it? We just rejected it without explanation. What are we as a reviewing court? What's our role relative to that, reviewing that decision then? Do we just have to paw through the record and see whether that decision was justified, even if it's not further explained?
Well, correct. And I think that's where the evidence in the record that was reviewed by the department becomes very relevant is, you know, relator claims that there was not substantial evidence in this record. MDH submitted the agency record, and that evidence shows that it is supported, that there was and that because of what the criminal statute for possession of burglary tools, the elements of that crime, there is a rational connection between the facts that are in the record and the determination that there is a preponderance of evidence that even though relator was not ultimately charged with a crime, and we don't know the reason why she wasn't charged with a crime, but under the statute that doesn't matter, because under a preponderance of evidence review, the department must disqualify an individual who's committed a felony level offense for possession of burglary tools. There's no discretion. There's no, you know, the relator's character and criminal history and whether this was an isolated incident, that's relevant to the risk of harm analysis. But under the correctness review, there's no discretion there for the department. And with that, Your Honor, unless the court has any additional questions, I do not have much else. And so in conclusion, would just ask that the court upholds the department's affirm MDH's denial of relator's request for reconsideration, as the decision was reasonable, it was supported by substantial evidence, and it was without errors of law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Voss. Any rebuttal? You are on mute, Mr. Squire.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So I'd like to start off, I want to go first to what Judge Connolly cited, you know, the initial risk of harm assessment, which first I want to point out, this is just the initial set-aside decision. You know, there's not an additional piece that, you know, MDH or DHS ever did to analyze, you know, whether or not her initial reconsideration request was correct. But even granting, you know, the proposition that maybe it was, in there they mentioned that she was the passenger in a stolen vehicle, as, you know, within the three sentences they ever bothered to put to paper, right? So clearly in somebody's mind at MDH, when they were doing this review, they thought that was important. And that's something that now LMP submitted additional evidence to rebut. And we don't know, we have no idea what MDH or DHS made of any of that evidence. They've left us in the dark. And I want to push back. I don't agree with the commissioner's contention that somehow, you know, the Background Studies Act statute doesn't require them to explain their decision making. You know, when they're engaged in a quasi judicial act, as they are when they're reviewing this request for reconsideration, they're required to explain their decision making. You know, this isn't like some obscure area of law. This is, you know, basic common administrative law that they need to explain what facts were found and how those facts connect to the conclusion in order for you to engage in judicial review. You know, As Ms. Voss stated, she basically, you know, Judge Smith asked her, are you basically asking us to do this for you? And she said, yes, we provided the administrative record, get in there, judges, dig through and tell us that we did a good job and we were right, even though we didn't bother to explain any of this. That's not the appropriate role of judicial review. You know, the agencies have an obligation to provide a sufficient evidence and explanation to allow this court to engage in judicial review. They simply haven't done it. If they don't think she provided enough evidence, explain why. They didn't. They just said she didn't. If they think, you know, this is such a strong case, you know, it's easy for them to find what facts were found and how it relates to their decision.
The concern, I mean, the problem with the case here, I think from your client's perspective, is there was no hearing sought on the, there would be a whole record on this and more would have had to be done had there been an initial appeal done, right? Correct. And instead, yes, it's a couple of years later and what's submitted is, you know, I ice fish, and that's how I use it. Mm-hmm. You know, what, and the agency, it's not like they have a hearing going. Mm-hmm. They don't have subpoena power to bring in the police and her or whatever and to have witnesses testify to it. Mm-hmm. What do you expect should have, besides explaining it, which I understand the argument, let's just get into what you expect the agency to actually do to decide whether that first decision, which was conclusively determined, is in fact incorrect.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, I don't think they need to produce the same level of evidence or formality that they would if there was a fair hearing request. We're not arguing that. I want to be clear. But I do think they need to have somebody at the agency sit down, look through the evidence, write down that, you know, they submitted this evidence. We don't think it's persuasive because of why. You know, enough to give, you know, this court an understanding. And I think when you look at the...
So, counsel, could we just simply remand for additional finding, for factual findings then?
I mean, that's certainly an option for the court. Given the length of time at which, you know, since this is the second reconsideration request, you know, we even, you know, requested, you know, pointed out during this process that it looked like they hadn't done this and they still haven't done anything. And now we're here in front of you at the Court of Appeals, we think reversal is the appropriate remedy since they've had their opportunity to do something. They simply haven't done anything. And I don't think it's appropriate or necessary to drag LMP through this process, you know, for another, you know, who knows, year if they issue a new decision and then she has to issue a new writ of certiorari, or, you know, if you reverse, you know, they could start this whole process over again, you know, from fresh too, if they want. But I don't think a remand here is appropriate, you know, given how clear the law on this has been.
Well, if the choice is between affirming and remanding, I'm assuming that's not the position you're going to hold too strongly.
That's a fair point, Your Honor. Well, that's my time.
Well, thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your written submissions and for your oral presentation today. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period, and we've taken the matter under advisement. Thank you. And